Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 112 countries over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the richest nation on Earth, right after this. Hey, are you concerned about your privacy? Well, how much does your government know about you, and how much do you want your government to know about you? Well, government only knows as much about us as we tell them about ourselves, because everything the government, industry, or business knows about us is because you and I told them. Now, the Fourth Amendment protects us in our person, houses, papers, and effects, but it doesn't protect us from ourselves. Now, can we have privacy in the computer age? Well, you bet we can. Information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. It's knowing how this information is being gathered. It's knowing what information is being stored. And it's knowing what information you want to keep personal and private that actually puts us in the driver's seat in our quest for privacy. Now, always keep in mind that no one knows anything about you that you have not revealed by your own hand or by your own mouth. Now, if you'd like to learn more about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call and ask for our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour program, and it's entertaining, it's informative, it's educational. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about the richest nation in the world, sparked by a comment made by a young woman on the Lehrer News Hour last week, and she said that America is the richest nation on Earth, and that we rack around number 10 in health care providing with of the industrialized nations of the world, about number 10 in providing health care for our population. And, of course, she's a Democrat. She's a liberal. She believes that we should have universal health care coverage for everyone. And she wants to pay for it with the taxpayers paying the premiums for the 44 million people here in America that don't have health care insurance. Now, if only 44 million people in this country do not have health care insurance, we have 300 million people in the country. So if we were to take 44 and divide that by 300, that would be 14%, wouldn't it? So that would tell me then that 86% of Americans have health care insurance. Now, it would sound like to me that if 86% of us have health care insurance, then it's practically universal. And the 14% that don't have this health care insurance are evidently the poor people who can't afford it. This is the general assumption. I want to tell you that I'm not poor. I don't have health care insurance, and I don't want it, and I don't want to pay for yours. I'm not opposed to you having health care insurance. I don't want it. I don't want to pay for it. I don't want to buy it. I don't want to use it. I don't want anything to do with it, and I don't want to pay for yours. But if you want it, get out there and buy it. I don't have a Rolls Royce, and I guess if I really put my mind to it, maybe I could afford one. I probably, if I wanted to sell off something here that I really like, maybe I could afford a Rolls Royce, but I don't have one. I'm not going to buy one. and I'm not going to rent one, lease one, or use one. I'm not opposed to Rolls-Royces, and if you want one, you certainly are entitled to go out and buy one, but I don't want to buy one for you. I don't want to pay for it for you, but I don't want to get in your way and prevent you from having one, buying one, using one. That's a choice that you make in life, and if that's your choice in life, get after it. I can think of better things to do with my money than to buy a Rolls-Royce. I can think of better things to do with my money than buy health insurance. But there's a political agenda out here, and these people with this political agenda have been pushing it for as long as I can remember. And that is, they want national health care insurance. What they really want is socialized medicine. Frankly, I don't even want to participate in medicine. I don't go to medical doctors. I don't practice allopathic medical practice. And I'm not opposed to those that want to. I'm not opposed to people that want to practice witchcraft. If that's your choice in life, you know, get after it. It would seem like to me, though, that there's a better solution to health problems than the kind of health care that these people are trying to enforce upon the rest of us. But, you know, again, I think that freedom of choice mandates that I butt out and let you people do what you want to do. The thing that bothers me is that you people want to enforce this on me. It's such a good plan. It's in your mind, it's such a good thing that you want me to participate in it and you want me to pay for your health care. And I don't want to do that. Now, I don't participate in and I don't practice insurance. I'll cover that insurance thing a little later. But I want to bring to your attention this thing of corporations, because corporations are involved in this health care program. You see, the insurance companies came out and they said that we all ought to have automobile insurance. They went to the legislatures and they said, if you don't have insurance, bad things happen. Accidents occur and people don't pay for them. So what we need is to have universal, mandatory automobile insurance. And so they forced that on all of us. And we have to go out and buy this insurance whether we want it or not. That doesn't benefit you and it doesn't benefit me, but it does benefit the insurance industry. I mean, hell, it would benefit anybody. Let's suppose that we had a universal, mandatory carpet law that required everybody in the country to have wall-to-wall carpeting in at least two rooms of their homes under penalty of 90 days or 180 days in jail. That'd be a wonderful thing for the carpet industry. I don't deny it. How about universal mandatory automobile ownership? I mean, you have to be able to prove that you've got an automobile. If you don't have one, we're going to put you in jail or fine you. So it may well be that automobile insurance is a wonderful thing. I'm not arguing with you people about the merits of your product over here. I'm arguing with you over the morality or the legal issue of should we compel people to buy things they don't want. Now, in this country, we decided that everybody, whether they want it or not, should have to buy auto insurance. It's a hell of a boon to the auto insurance industry, makes them a lot of money. And in case you thought that the auto insurance industry, you know, is the final arbiter of paying people when there's a damage, let me tell you something. If an auto insurance company has a claim for $100,000, let's suppose you walk in, you say, hey, listen, your policyholder damaged me and the amount was $100,000 or more. You cannot get paid. You will not be paid unless you sue them and win in court. There isn't a single auto insurance company in the United States of America that will pay a claim of $100,000 or more without a jury verdict. You understand that? So much for your argument that insurance solves the problem of the uninsured. It doesn't make any difference whether you got insurance or not. You're not going to get paid. Now, let me give you statistic number two. If you have a $100,000 claim and you take your case to court and you go argue your claim, how much money, on average, will the insurance company pay you? And the answer is 9%. That's how much you're going to get paid. So if you have $1 million claim, you're going to get paid $90,000 on your claim. And that's assuming that the guy's got insurance. That's the average. That's the average. Hell, I could do better than that with an indigent, I think. Couldn't do much worse. Now, the auto insurance people, they love it. They're making a lot of money off of it, and evidently you're happy with it, and so I'll get after it. So now they want to extend this to health care insurance. We're all going to pay for it whether we like it or not. And I think that you're going to have just about the same outcome from national health care insurance as you're going to get or you have or are getting right now from auto insurance. Now, back in 1936, a guy wrote a book called Corporations and Natural Rights, dealing with corporations. Now, the people that are pushing this are corporations. I'm not pushing. You're not pushing it. All of us little guys down here at the bottom of the feeding pool over here, we aren't out here pushing this healthcare insurance. We may have an opinion as to whether we want it or not. But, you know, you're not going into the legislature and testifying before the committees. When was the last time you went into your state legislature and testified before the Health and Welfare Committee that you wanted, universal health care coverage? Huh? But let me tell you that every single session you've got insurance company executives and think tank operatives and lobbyists testifying. Every single session. I mean, you've got lobbyists for the insurance industry and the American Medical Association and all these medical people. They're testifying, they're lobbying, they're twisting arms. When was the last time you gave a contribution to some politician for the express purpose of motivating them in health care? Probably never, but you can rest assured that big corporations are out there giving millions of dollars to politicians to get their votes to get this process put through. So there's a push for it. There's a reason for it. But that doesn't mean that it's going to benefit you and I. I mean, even if you get this health care insurance that you're lusting and coveting after, doesn't mean that you're going to have a better program or that's going to save your life when you get cancer. Now, listen to this. Under the dual system of equal rights for natural persons and for corporate persons, the American economy has passed over the long road from the days of the fathers to the latest hour. And I want to remind you that this was written back in 1936. So keep in mind that this story I'm telling you right now isn't something that Bill Clinton thought up or I thought up. This is written in 1936. Hell, this was written before I was born. The American economy has passed over the long road from the days of the fathers to the latest hour. For readers of this journal, it isn't necessary to describe even briefly the present situation. They're familiar with surveys of contemporary economy as may be found in Burl and Means. The modern corporation and private property. Nearly 80% of the business wealth of this nation is concentrated in the hands of corporations. So get your pen out there, boys and girls, and write down 80%. All right, this is 1936. 80% of the business wealth of the United States of America in 1936 was in the hands of corporations. Let me ask you this. In the year 2008, what do you think the percentage of business wealth owned by corporations is? More or less than 80%? Because in 1936, only 20% of the business wealth in the country was in the hands of mom and pops, operating a little store over here, or operating a farm, or doing this or that, or something else. 80% was in the hands of corporations as early as 1936. And about 50% of the corporate wealth and 40% of the business wealth is in the hands of 200 corporations in a nation of 120 million natural persons. So 50% of the corporate wealth and 40% of the business wealth is in the hands of just 200 corporations. What do you think Fortune 500 owns? More or less? And then the rest of it's in the hands of mom and pops or the other corporations. So if we take a look at the wealth of you and I, just the little guys down here, in 1936, our percent of the pie was 20%, and General Motors and Ford had 80%. Then, if you take a look at the corporations, how much of that corporate wealth is in the hands of the biggies, like General Motors and Ford, it was 50 and 40% in the hands of just 200 of these big corporations. Now, there are literally tens of thousands of corporations around America. But when you get down to how much wealth do you and I have as workers, as farmers, housewives, small businessmen, you know, to say that we're getting the crumbs off the table would be a generous statement. Crumbs would be generous. Nor is it necessary to speak of the achievements of corporations in amassing great capital far beyond the reach of any natural person, and in developing great industrial, commercial, and transportation enterprises. Nor is it necessary to recite the story of corporate abuses, stock watering, holding company pyramiding, underground lobbying, and all of the rest, painful incidents, and the revelations of many congressional investigations are already too poignantly in the minds of informed persons. The question is, well, what's the upshot of it? That's 1936. Did you get that? Corporate abuses, stock watering, holding company pyramiding, underground lobbying, and all the rest. Painful incidents and revelations of many congressional investigations. Hell, that sounds like the Lair News report, doesn't it? Every night on the news, there's some new scandal coming up here from Kellogg Brown and Root, or from General Motors or Ford, or from, you know, from some lobbying like Jack Abrams or Abramoff or whatever his name was, ain't it? I mean, hell, nothing's changed. The question is not easy to answer, but a few relevant facts may be set down for consideration. It is certain that vast changes have been made in the American economy under this dual system of rights. Agriculture no longer overbalances industry, commerce, and finance many times, as it did in 1787. Both in capital invested and the number of natural persons employed in agriculture is now far below the combined forms of industrialist enterprise. The old days in which industries were carried on largely under the direction of individual masters has now passed. The old days of isolated shops, mills, and stores, individually owned and operated largely with reference to local needs, have now passed into history. The free land to which discontented mechanics and the sons and daughters of farmers could escape has now disappeared. America is no longer a nation of homeowning and independent farmers as envisioned by Jefferson. It is mainly a nation of industrial workers, white-collar employees, debt-burdened farmers, tenants, sharecroppers, and casual laborers. And the opportunity for natural persons to acquire physical property, to manage that property, to operate that property, and then to enjoy the fruits of that property in security now has materially declined. The household arts which enabled farmers and their wives to guarantee security to themselves have practically vanished. Nearly all of the owners of small properties, such as stores and garages and gasoline stands and pants-pressing establishments, are pitifully dependent for survival, to say nothing of a living, upon the general state of the national economy as a whole. Finally, it is to be noted that the old days when America furnished vast quantities of raw materials and farm produce to the developing capitalism of Europe have now passed. Indeed, the entire balance of world economy has shifted since 1787. Indeed, since 1890. Hence, even corporate enterprise finds itself hampered and blocked and harassed in the quest for markets, domestic and foreign, in which to sell the flooding output of its vast technology. Surely none will deny the immensity of this transformation in our economy, in which natural persons are to enjoy the natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Surely none will deny the disparity between individual natural persons and individual corporate persons in wealth, economic power, and political influence. If the corporate person is to enjoy all of the rights of natural persons, then the dice of fortune are clearly loaded on its side. And if corporations cannot provide employment for the millions of the American proletariat, for such we have, in spite of all the claptrap to the contrary, can corporate persons expect to protect themselves forever through constitutional and judicial processes against the distresses and distempers of natural persons twisting and turning in their search for the rights to life, liberty, and property declared in the American Constitution? If the history of past experiences of mankind on its long road from barbarism means anything, if history is not closed against future changes, and if the American economy is not now congealed in a perpetual frost, it seems reasonable to accept and to expect a negative answer to this fateful question. Certainly, the rattle and chatter of liberty, leagues, sentinels, professional patriots, corporation lawyers, the hack candidates of the political parties, and all the other ritual reciters is no more reliant to the present moral and economic dilemma than the incantations of the medicine man in the presence of virulent smallpox. History is merciless, and only the strong can endure it. If there's any doubt on this score, surely the fate of Victorian dreams of yesteryear, as illustrated in the agony of present Europe, ought to dispel that doubt, at least for those intelligent enough to come in out of the rain. History is merciless to artificial persons as well as to natural persons. Indeed, more merciless for natural persons in some number may live in caves and so on, wild berries, and continue their life in some fashion on some level. Now, you know, this isn't any strange doctrine for American ears. Jefferson knew that nations are not immortal, that governments are transient, that governments are concentrated, and that concentrated wealth and widespread poverty cannot forever endure side by side in a democracy. And Madison was equally well acquainted with the long story of mankind. And Madison warned his countrymen of the perils to come. And in the Constitutional Convention on August 7, 1787, 1787, James Madison said this. He said, "In future times, a great majority of our people will not only be without landed, but any other sort of property." That's a pretty profound statement there, boys and girls. Thomas Jefferson in a Constitutional Convention said, "In future times, the people of America will be devoid of land." You're living in that time. And then he went on to say, "or any other sort of property." Well, boys and girls, you're living in that time. I brought out to you that in America, we don't have $2,200. The majority of Americans do not have a balance sheet with a net of $2,200 on it. And remember, this young woman said America is the richest nation on earth. For this woman to come to the conclusion that America is the richest nation in the world, based upon just the facts that I've given you so far, boasts of the woman's ignorance. It reveals that she has lost touch with reality. And it shows plainly that the woman is clearly delusional. If you believe that the United States of America is the richest nation on earth, you're ignorant, you're out of touch with reality, and you're delusional. And that was as of 1936, boys and girls. 36. That was true. We weren't the richest nation in the world in 1936. And we haven't been the richest nation in the world in any year from that day to this. Now, it is true, boys and girls, it is true that we Americans are in possession of more wealth than anybody else in the world. I don't deny that. We have more SUVs, and we live in bigger, better houses, and we have more toys to play with than anybody else in the world. But we don't own the houses that we live in, we don't own the cars that we're driving, and we don't own the toys that we're playing with. The toys belong to Ronnie Mitchell. And you're over here and living in and playing in somebody else's house. Now, you can take some poor, we'll call him poor, actually he's wealthier than you are. We could take some poor Filipino with 2 acres of rice, 2 acres of rice land. And the Filipino who owns 2 acres, free and clear, in the Philippines, and he has a little shack on his 2 acres, and he produces $700 a year. Oh, let's give him a little bit more than that. Let's give him $2 a day, 365 times 2. $730 a year. Let's give him $730 a year worth of income off of his 2 acres. That Filipino farmer has more real wealth. He's in possession of and owns more wealth than more than 50% of the people of America. I don't care, Doc, if you're making $1 million a year. I have people that come through school here from time to time, you know, that are making $1 million a year. I always like to ask them, you know, if I can get it out of them, what their financial position is. Financial position. People that are making $1 million a year, you know, if you're a truck driver driving down the road listening to me right now, that's your god-awful, honest to God dream is to make $1 million a year. To give you an illustration as to how much that is, if you were making $1 million a year, gross, let's plug it in here, 100,000, there's $1 million. And let's divide that by 2,000 hours in a year. You're making $500 an hour. Oh God, can't you just picture yourself making $500 an hour? I mean, that's where you want to get, you know, making $1 million a year. Now, when these people come in here and they're making $1 million a year, and that's pretty good income, and then you got to ask, well, Doc, do you own your business? Do you own your practice? Do you own the building? Do you own your home? Do you own those cars? Do you own those toys? What's your balance sheet look like, Doc? Now, these people, most people that have $1 million a year income, these people actually have some wealth. If you took a look at their balance sheet, they're not free and clear. They're making $1 million a year. They probably have, assets, stocks, bonds. They can have gold and silver, and they can have, you know, very real estate investments, you know, all over. These people typically will have a balance sheet, and then they may have $3-4 million on their balance sheet, and they owe $2 million, and so their balance sheet shows that they have a net worth of $2 million, or maybe more. Boys and girls, that's not as good a position to be in as owning 2 acres in the Philippines, frankly. I tell my students very often, I say, you know, you're better off to own a cottage, free and clear, than a mansion with a mortgage. Because, you see, the doctor is just one payment from losing it all. One payment. Now, all you people out there driving your SUVs, I mean, you know, it isn't one payment, it's about three. You just miss three payments on your SUV, and one of these days you'll walk out the door and your car is missing from your driveway. You know, you miss about three payments, you know, on your house, and you're going to have foreclosure, aren't you? So, you know, you're just a few payments away from living in the streets. The Filipino over there, he's not three payments away from living in the streets. It's true, he doesn't have a nice, neat house like you've got in Bellwood Estates, but he's not three payments away from the street. It's true, he doesn't even have an automobile, but nobody's going to come and take his bicycle. He owns it. So if he's got $2,200 free and clear, he's in a better financial position than you are. Well, that's true. You're living better. You got electric lights, and it's true. You're driving a nice SUV, and you got more toys at your disposal. But that's about to come to an end here in the United States, boys and girls, and it's time for us to wake up and smell the coffee. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio worldwide. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and that's for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service. It's brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. And these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs, the views, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the richest nation on earth. Remember, if you've got $2,200 net, or the equivalent thereto, you're in the top 50% of wealth holders in the world. If you've got $500,000 net, $500,000 net, you're in the top 1% of the population of the world in wealth. 500,000. That's not a lot of money for people here in the Western world, $500,000. Now, it might be a lot of money for most Americans, and I don't deny that, but it's very common to run across people that have $500,000 worth of land, houses, and they're free and clear. I mean, free and clear. They don't owe any money. There's a lot of people like that, but compared to the national average, it's not common. They're not in the majority by any stretch of the imagination. Now, let me bring you over here to the agenda. There's a story that was written back in 1884. It's called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and it was published. It was done in Zurich, Switzerland in 1884, and then it was published in Russia, and it was published out of Russia in Paris, France in 1909. Henry Ford picked up on it, and he published it in the Dearborn Gazette, I believe it was. Dearborn something or other. Anyway, Henry Ford bought a newspaper. He was pretty impressed by it, so he published it. And there's been books written. Of course, it's politically incorrect, you know, to identify any racial or ethnic group of people with something political. And so that makes them mad. And, of course, then the rest of us, especially politicians, they don't want to lose their votes. And so, therefore, they kind of pander to them. Let me bring you through some of these protocols, because all of these protocols that were published back in 1884 have already been put into operation. So once in a while somebody will send me a letter and they'll say, I'm a Jew and we deny it. Okay. Let's suppose that this was written by communists. Okay. I'll write down communists here. Let's suppose that this was written, or this program was put out by Republicans, George Bush and company. I'll put Republicans down here, number two. Now let's suppose maybe it's not communists or Republicans. Let's suppose it's Democrats. Okay. All right, now let's suppose that it's Republicans, Democrats, communists. Let's just put down socialists. Let's put down Nazis. Let's put down fascists. Now, let's leave politics and let's get on to religion. Let's suppose it's put out by Islamists, Christians, Buddhists, Jews. So, whether these protocols were written by communists, Republicans, Democrats, socialists, Nazis, fascists, Islamists, Christians, Buddhists, or Jews is irrelevant. Don't care who wrote them. They, according to my information, were written in 1884. Doesn't make any difference when they were written. They could have been written in 1730. They could have been written in 600 B.C. They could have been written 3 years ago. Didn't make any difference when. The point is, all of these protocols have already been put into full force and effect. They're already here. It's already done. So I'm not going to tell you something that's going to happen in the future. And if you don't vote for Hillary Clinton, god-awful catastrophes are going to befall you in the morning. It doesn't make any difference who you vote for. There's not a candidate out there that's going to change anything that I'm going to report to you right now. All right. This is the seventh protocol. These aren't in order, but I just wanted to take the highlights of each one of these and point out that this is the state of affairs in the United States of America. It's the state of affairs in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Wales, England, Ireland, Switzerland, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan. I don't care where you live in the world. Brazil, South Africa, Australia. Wherever you live in the world, this is the state of affairs that's been brought about. Now, the people that should get the credit for this are the international Zionists. I mean, after all, they're the ones that thought it up. They're the ones that promoted it. They're the ones that have worked diligently to bring about this state of affairs. And they have succeeded. They have now put this into effect worldwide. And they're on the verge of producing this utopian new world order. So here's what they've accomplished. They said in 1884, to each act of opposition, we must be in a position to respond by bringing on war through the neighbors of any country that dares to oppose us. And if these neighbors should plan to stand collectively against us, we must let loose a world war. Boys and girls, we have had two world wars, and we're on the brink of number three. And just take a look at Iraq and Afghanistan. Anybody, you Palestinians, you Arabs out there, anybody that stands in the way, they will bring war upon you and smash you. So I'm not telling you something that's going to happen. I'm just revealing to you what you're watching every night just listening to Katie and Brian. Katie, Brian, and Charlie. Here's the ninth protocol. People of all opinions and all doctrines are at our service. Restorers of monarchy, demagogues, socialists, communists, and other utopians. We've put them all to work. Every one of them, from his point of view, is undermining the last remnant of authority and is trying to overthrow all existing order. All of the governments have been tormented by these actions. But we will not give them peace until they recognize our super government. The tenth protocol. When we introduce the poison of liberalism into the government organism, its entire political complexion changed. When Franklin D. Roosevelt introduced liberalism into the American government, its entire political complexion changed. Boys and girls, nothing's been the same since 1933. And this United Nations over here is in control. And they're going to create this new super government, whether we like it or not. And furthermore, God himself tells us that they're going to succeed in their plan for a short period of time, described in Bible prophecy as 1 hour. Not very long, but they're going to succeed. And boy, are these guys going to raise hell when they succeed. The ninth protocol says this: in order not to destroy prematurely the Gentile institutions, we have laid our efficient hands upon them and rasped the springs of their mechanism. They were formerly in strict and just order, but we have replaced them with a liberal, disorganized, and arbitrary administration. We have tampered with jurisprudence, the franchise, the press, freedom of the person, and most important of all, education and culture, the cornerstone of free existence. We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories, patently false to us, but which we have inspired. And above existing laws, and without actual change, but by distorting them through contradictory interpretations, we have created something stupendous in the way of results. Boy, have they. The sixth protocol. They say, we shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the political catastrophe. The economists here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination, and we must develop by every means the importance of our super government, representing it as the protector and the benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. The aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away, and we need not take them into consideration. But as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. And the best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and the mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. And at the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation. The function of speculation is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Because without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. It is necessary, therefore, for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital, and through speculations, transfer all of the money of the world into our hands. thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. The sixth protocol goes on to say, we will force up wages, which, however, will be of no benefit to workers, because at the same time, we will cause a rise in the prices of prime necessities, pretending that this is due to a decline of agriculture and cattle raising. And we will also artfully and deeply undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy and encourage them in the use of alcohol, at the same time taking measures to drive all of the intellectual forces of the Gentiles from the land. The tenth protocol, to wear everyone out by dissension, animosity, feuds, famine, inoculation of diseases, and want, until the Gentiles see no other way of escape except an appeal to our money and our power. The fourth protocol. It's for this reason that we must undermine faith and eradicate from the minds of the Gentiles the very principles of God and soul, and replace these conceptions by mathematical calculations and material desires. The fifth protocol. We shall so wear out and exhaust the Gentiles by all of this that they will be compelled to offer us an international authority, which by its position will enable us to absorb without disturbance all of the governmental forces of the world, and thus form a super-government. And we must so direct the education of Gentile society that its hands will drop in the weakness of discouragement in the face of any undertaking where initiative is needed. The 14th protocol. When we become rulers, we shall regard as undesirable the existence of any religion except our own, proclaiming one God with whom our fate is tied as the chosen people, and by whom our fate has been made one with the fate of the world. And for this reason, we must destroy all other religions. If thereby should emerge contemporary atheists, then, as a transition step, this will not interfere with our aims. The fifth protocol. A world coalition of Gentiles could cope with us temporarily, but we are assured against this by roots of dissension among them so deep that they cannot be torn out. We have created antagonisms between the personal and national interests of the Gentiles by arousing religious and race hatreds which we have nourished in their hearts for 20 centuries. The second protocol. The administration chosen by us from the masses for their servility will not be persons trained for government, and consequently they will easily become pawns in our game, played by our learned and talented counselors, specialists, and educated from early childhood to administer world affairs. As we know, our specialists have been acquiring the necessary knowledge for governing. The 13th protocol. To prevent them from really thinking about anything themselves, we shall deflect their attention to amusements, games, pastimes, excitements, and people's palaces. Such interests will distract their minds completely from questions on which we might be obliged to struggle with them. Becoming less and less accustomed to independent thinking, people will express themselves in unison with us, because we alone offer new lines of thought, and of course through persons whom they do not consider as in any way connected with us. The 13th protocol. And in the 14th protocol again, in this divergence between the Gentiles and ourselves in ability to think and reason, is to be seen clearly the seal of our election as the chosen people, as higher human beings, in contrast with the Gentiles who have merely instinctive and animal minds. They observe, but they do not foresee. And they invent nothing except material things. It is clear from this that nature herself predestined us to rule and to guide the world. The 12th protocol, dealing with the press. We shall handle the press in the following manner. We shall saddle it and keep tight rein upon it. We shall do the same also with other printed matter, for of what use is it to us to rid ourselves of attacks in the press if we remain exposed to criticism through pamphlets and books? Not one announcement will reach the people save under our supervision. And we have attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it is centralized from all parts of the world. Literature and journalism are two most important educational forces, and consequently our government will become the owner of most of these journals. If we permit 10 private journals, we shall organize 30 of our own, and so on. This must not be suspected by the public, for which reason all of the journals published by us will be externally of the most contrary opinions and tendencies, thus evoking confidence in them and attracting our unsuspecting opponents, who thus will be caught in our trap and rendered harmless. The first protocol. Our triumph has been rendered easier by the fact that in our relations with the men whom we wanted, we have always worked upon the most sensitive chords of the human mind, upon the cash account, upon the cupidity, upon the insatiability for material needs of man. And each one of these human weaknesses, taken alone, is sufficient to paralyze initiative, because it hands over the will of men to the disposition of him who has bought their activities. And finally, let us all recognize that we Jews are distinct, and a distinct nationality of which every Jew, whatever his country, whatever his station, or whatever his shade of belief, is necessarily a member. That was a direct quotation from Louis D. Brandeis, Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Now, in the final minutes, let me take a couple of three of these protocols, and let's just run through them and take a look and see where are we on the scale. Let's take a look at the press, where it says, we shall saddle the press and keep tight rein upon it. We shall do the same also with other printed matter. For of what use is it to rid ourselves of attacks in the press if we remain exposed to criticism through pamphlets and books? Do you remember the story of John Swinton? John Swinton. I read this every so often, where John Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. This was in 1880. 1880, boys and girls. 4 years before the protocols were even published, John Swinton said this. Swinton was a guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft, and someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press, and Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying, boys and girls, let me outrage all of my colleagues in the press by revealing to you there is no such thing at this date in world history in America as an independent press. You know it and I know it. And I'm here to tell you, there isn't anything in the United States of America that even smacks of a free press. Why is that? Not one announcement will reach the people except under our supervision. Boys and girls, there are no announcements that aren't carefully scrutinized and sent to you from the 9/11 story about how these Arab terrorists crashed these airplanes into these buildings. That was a carefully orchestrated news event. It came to you directly from CBS, NBC, and ABC. You watched those buildings burn on your television set. Orchestrated. Brought right into your living room. And they went on to point out, we've attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it's centralized from all parts of the world. We call this Reuters, or Reuters, and Associated Press and United Press International. All news gathered from around the world is centralized. And what Katie Couric and Brian Williams tell you on the 6 o'clock news is what you're supposed to hear. What you see on the Lehr NewsHour, when this young woman comes on the NewsHour and is being interviewed, that's what we're supposed to see. And that is that national health care insurance is a right that belongs to every American. That's what that young woman said. And that's what you and I are supposed to believe. That's not what our founding fathers believed. That's not what our creator believed. And insurance is a crime. It's a criminal activity. And it is strictly prohibited by our creator in the Bible. Insurance. Auto insurance, health insurance, fire insurance. It's called limited liability, and it's prohibited as a matter of law. And you learned about insurance in public school, didn't you? Remember, education is a powerful force, and we must control education. Education is public education, is controlled by your government. They determine what you're going to learn and what you're not going to learn. It's called a liberal arts education. Literature and journalism are two most important educational forces, and consequently our government will become the owner of most of the journals. There is a little bit of private information out there. I've introduced you to the International Forecaster, the Money Changer, the Privateer, the Law Hour, and Editorial Review. There's some private information. There's not much of it. When they allow a few of us, you can rest assured that they have 30 of their own to counter anything that I have to say. If we permit 10 private journals, like George Gordon and the International Forecaster, we shall organize 30 of our own, and so on. This must not be suspected by the public, though, for which reason all of the journals published by us will be externally of the most contrary opinions and tendencies, thus evoking confidence in them. Boys and girls, aren't you confident when you listen to 2020, Dateline, and 60 Minutes? Aren't they of the most controversial? Don't they evoke confidence in you? In them and attracting our unsuspecting opponents, and thus will be caught in our trap and rendered harmless. All right, boys and girls, we're about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thank you for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.